The basic political system in the ancient Near East was monarchy. There were kings, different kinds of kings of empires and kings of city-states, but it was monarchies and kings were in control. Which rings when we ask the political question about the Bible. This is the question we need to ask. What does the Bible, what does the Torah think about monarchy? What does it think about kings? And the surprising thing is that in the five books of Moshe, the monarchy, kingdom, kings are barely mentioned. The king is absent from almost all the books of the Torah. For example, in the book of Leviticus describes different sin offerings that people with power have to offer if they've sinned. Like it says, Asher Nasi Yecheta, when a Nasi, Nasi is a leader of a tribe. When a Nasi sins, what's the Korban Chatat? What's the sin offering that he has to offer? Asher Kohen Yecheta, when a priest sins, what's the sin offering that he has to offer? It doesn't say Asher Melech Yecheta. There is no sin offering that a king that sins has to offer. Why? Is it because the book of Leviticus thinks and believes that kings don't sin? I doubt it. I think the reason is that Leviticus is not aware of kings. It ignores the existence of a king. In the book of Exodus, in the book of Shemot, it describes you're not allowed to curse people that have authority. Elohim lo tekalel, you're not allowed to curse a judge. V'nasi be'amcha lo ta'or, you're not allowed to speak badly. You're not allowed to curse a nasi meaning a leader of a tribe. It doesn't say melech lo tekalel, melech lo ta'or. It doesn't say you're not allowed to curse a king. Is it because the book of Exodus thinks it's allowed to curse a king? I doubt it. It's not aware. It's ignoring the king. The king is missing, and it's missing exactly in the places where you expect the king to be mentioned, to appear. Where is the king? Now, anyone of you that read the book of Kings know that kings are dominant. They have such a dominant role in the book of Kings and such a peripheral role in the Torah, and that asymmetry is interesting. In the Torah, it barely exists, but then in the history books, the kings don't only exist, they're very central. How can you explain that asymmetry between the theory and the practice? In theory, there's no king. In practice, there's a very dominant king. The only place in the Torah where they're really dealing with a king is the book of Deuteronomy. It's only in a few verses in the book of Deuteronomy, and with that in mind, with the fact that the Torah ignores the king, we have to read these verses with that in mind, because this is the only information we'll have in the Torah about monarchy and about what we're supposed to think and treat, the way we're supposed to treat the king. So with all that in mind, that this is all we got, I want to read the verses in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14. And remember, these are the only verses in the Torah that deal with monarchy, which means these verses carry a lot of political weight. Ki tavo el haaretz, asher Adonai Elohecha noten lecha v'yirishta. It says, when you'll enter Eretz Knaan, will you enter the promised land that God has promised you and v'yirishta, and you conquer it, v'yashavta ba, and you build communities in it, and you settle it. So three things have to happen. You enter the land, you conquer the land, you settle the land. And after those three, that triple historical move, something happens. The Amarta, Asima alai melech, kechol hagoyim asher svivotai. So then after, you're established in the promised land, you might ask for a king. If that happens, and moving to verse 15 now, Som tasim alecha melech. If that happens, so you shall appoint a king. There's an interesting disagreement here among interpreters. in the Mishnah, in the Talmud, and in the Middle Ages. Are we supposed to appoint a king? Rambam writes that this is a mitzvah to say. It's a commandment. Som tasim alecha melech. We are commanded to appoint a king. But the context doesn't seem positive. Because it says som tasim alecha melech right after it said that the people ask, Ve'amarta asima alai melech kechol hagoyim asher sivotai. If there is one thing that any reader of Deuteronomy knows, that the worst thing we can do is imitate the local nations, the goyim. And asking for a king is imitating the goyim, is trying to be just like everyone else. And if there is a subtext in the Torah, and in Deuteronomy especially, is do everything you can to be special, to be unique, and not to be like everyone else. So the context is negative. You want to be like everyone else. But the commandment is positive. Som tasim alecha melech. So are we listening to the negative context or to the positive commandment? Rambam is listening to the positive commandment. Rabbi Yitzchak Abarbanel is listening to the context, and he says it's wrong to ask for a king. But if they ask for a king, okay, here are the conditions. These are the conditions if you ask for a king. And there are a lot of conditions. Here they are. One. Som tasim alecha melech asher yivchar Adonai Elohecha mikerev achecha tasim alecha melech. Lo tuchal letet alecha ish nochri asher lo achicha hu. You can't appoint a king which is not one of your brothers, one of the Israelites. So it's interesting. You want a king like the Gentiles, but the king can't be a Gentile. And there's something else going on here. Mikerev achecha tasim alecha melech. The metaphor of brotherhood is going to reappear here later on. You'll see. Lebilti rum levavo me'echav. The metaphor of brotherhood is going to reappear here, where the book of Deuteronomy is emphasizing that the king is your brother. That's the metaphor. Now, it's a weird metaphor to describe a king, your brother. The metaphor that would come to mind is father, right? Ataturk, Musa Kamal, is the father of Turkey. Nelson Mandela was the father of South Africa. In the United States, you're speaking about the founding fathers. Fatherhood. Father is the metaphor for king, for the founder. And here, the king is not the father, he's the brother. Now, the metaphor here is very important because what the metaphor of brotherhood does, it cracks any sense of hierarchy. Israelis are very good with this, by the way, using this metaphor. When a soldier tells his commander in the IDF, Achi, my brother, what is he actually doing? He's cracking the illusion. He's cracking the illusion of hierarchy. You're my brother. You're just like me. Deuteronomy, there is an egalitarian temperament in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, they call the slave your brother and the king your brother. There is hierarchy, but the metaphors crack the sense of hierarchy. The king, the slave, we're all brothers. We're all the same. And using the metaphor of brotherhood is an opening to understand the philosophy, the political philosophy of Deuteronomy. I'm continuing. Rak lo yarbelo susim. He can't have many horses. V'lo yashiv et ha'mitzrayim alemaan arbot sus. V'adonai amar lachen lo tosifun lashuv baderech hazeh od. V'lo yarbe lo nashim. He's not allowed to have many wives. V'lo yasur levavo. V'chesef v'zahav lo yarbe lo me'od. He can't have a lot of silver and gold. These three restrictions. Not a lot of gold, not many wives, and not many horses. What do they mean? Let's start with the wives. What does it mean? To understand this, we have to understand diplomacy of the ancient world, and especially the ancient Near East. How were diplomatic ties established in the ancient Near East? How were they established? Through marriage. When you marry the princess, when your son marries, when you marry the daughter of another king, now you're connected. Now there's a political alliance. Because in the ancient world, they believed that the best diplomacy, the best international relationships happen when we turn international relationships into family relationships. They actually believed that family politics are easier to manage than international politics. They actually believed that if we turn international relationships into mishpacha, internal family relationships, that creates the best diplomacy. So the way to create a political bond with another nation, it's foreign to us today, but it was natural to them then. And in light of that, if that's how you do alliance between nations, lo yarbe lo nishim, you're not allowed to have many wives. It actually means very limited diplomacy. It actually means that the Secretary of Misad HaChutz, the Secretary of State, is a very limited office. The amount of bonds and alliances, the amount of political maneuver, international maneuver they have to make is very limited. Lo yarbe lo susim. A second restriction. He's not allowed to have many horses. What does that mean? Well, today horses are nice to have. In the ancient world, what are horses? Those are the tanks of the army. That's military. That's the queen of the battlefield or the carriages. You're not allowed to have many horses means not only that your diplomacy is limited, lo yarbe lo nashim, your military is limited. Lo yarbe lo susim. And so it's not only the Secretary of State is limited, the Secretary of Defense, also that office, is limited. And finally, v'kesef v'zahav lo yarbe lo meod, that's a limitation on taxation. You can't overtax the people. This is the first and only time the Torah discusses political power. And when it discusses political power, the first thing it does, it imposes limitations on political power. Limited diplomacy, limited taxation, limited military. It's kind of like now, if we compare this to Egypt and Mesopotamia, if we compare this to the political systems you had in the Near East, what's happening here is very interesting. The people are asking for a king just like all the nations, but they're forming here a monarchy that is radically different than all the other nations, because it limits the power of the monarch. And there's something else going here. When are we supposed to ask for a king? When is the moment you found the monarchy? What's the moment of the establishment of the monarchy? After they enter Israel, after they conquer Israel, after they settle Israel, which means only after they established, they create a monarchy, they create a king. What does that do? That cracks the ability. It destroys the ability to glorify the king. The king is not the founding father. Not only that he's not a father, he's a brother. He's also not the founder. He's not the person that brought us here. It's not this dynasty that established here. Actually, we have a long memory of a society without a king. And only then we had a king. He's not the founder. We don't owe our existence to him. It's actually the other way around. It's not the king that founds the society. It's a society that creates the king. It's the other way around. So there were five moves here. He's not the founder. He's not the brother. Limited forces, limited wives, limited money, limited power. V'haya kishivto al kise mamlachto, in verse 18, when he sits on his throne, v'katavlo et mishne ha-Torah hazot, and he writes down a book, it probably means this book, the book of Deuteronomy. He's supposed to write down the last words of Moses. Milifnei ha-Kohanim ha-Levihim, in front of the priests, which are from the Levite tribe. So I don't really know what this means. I've been thinking about this a lot. What are you supposed to do? He's supposed to write a book in front of the priest. It's like a ceremony that he's in front of the priest and he's writing a book. What do they mean here? What's supposed to happen here? I don't know, but there's one thing that is clear that we can derive from this verse. If this verse locates the king in front of the priest, that means that the king is not the priest. This might be the most important move in the political philosophy of Deuteronomy. The separation of political power from religion. That the king is not the priest. Not only does it have limited diplomatic power and limited military and limited taxation, he also can't recruit religion and control the religion of the country. He is not the priest. He's in front of the priest. Not only he doesn't have control over Misad HaChutz and Misad HaBitachon, he also doesn't have Misad HaDatot. He also doesn't have control over the religious system. So there's a series of moves to limit the power of the king. The founding fathers of the United States of America quoted Deuteronomy more than they did Locke and Montesquieu and all the philosophers of the Enlightenment. I think this is the reason why they quoted Deuteronomy more than they quoted any other great text. It's because this is the first time in history we have the idea of limitation of power. Where does liberal democracy come from? So the classic theory is it comes from Athens, and it's true because democracy was born in Athens. But democracy has two pieces to it. You rule through the consent of the people. That is democracy. But your rule is limited. That is the liberal part of liberal democracy. I would say that liberal democracy has two pieces to it. One is the source of your power, the people. The second is limitations of your power. I would say the source of the power of democracy comes from Athens. The idea of limiting power comes from Jerusalem, comes from the Torah, comes from the last speech of Moshe, comes from the book of Deuteronomy. And the liberal democracies that we're enjoying are inspired by Athens and Jerusalem. And the liberal part, the limitation of power, that's the part of Jerusalem. Now he writes down Mishneh Torah, he writes down the book of Deuteronomy in front of the priest. And now the book has to be with him. He has to read this book his entire life. But I want to enjoy this verse. Because this is the, I want to remind you all. This is the only verses in the entire Torah that describe monarchy and describe the king. And this is the only activity we know that the king does in the Torah. It doesn't describe a king that goes to war. It doesn't describe a king that builds monuments. It only describes a king that reads a book. This is the only verse describing the activity of the king. The king is reading a book. Please don't bother him. So he's reading a book. That's the only activity. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't do other things. But the image of the king of Deuteronomy is the person that reads a book. Now, why does he have to spend his time, his energy and this intellectual activity of reading Mishneh Torah, reading the book of Deuteronomy? Why does he have to do that? Leman ilmad liyira et Adonai Elohav velishmor et kol divrei Torah hazot vet hachukim ha'eile la'asotam. Because it will have a therapeutic impact on him. Because by reading the book, he will learn to fear God that's above him. And that will lead to verse 20, Lebilti rum levavo me'ichav. Through reading this book, that will neutralize, quiet, or stop the tendency of political leaders to become arrogant and filled with hubris. Lebilti rum levavo me'ichav. So his heart won't be lifted. So he won't think that he's better than everyone else. Here's how the psychological system is supposed to work. A king is always exposed to the people who are beneath him. People who are obeying his orders. People who are looking up to him. The faces, the eyes, the temperament, the people that are beneath him could have a negative effect on him. It could change his self-awareness. He could start believing in the myth of himself. Now he's reading this book. In the book, he's exposed to something that's above him, something that's greater than him. That's why reading is what balances ruling. When he rules, he thinks he's great. When he reads, he realizes he's not great. Something else is great. He's not above everyone else. He's just like anyone else. The point of the king that reads is to balance the persona that rules, to block political hubris. Now we're almost at the end of the verses that describe the monarchy and kingdom and politics. And bear in mind, these are the only verses in the Torah that are trying to do this. And there's something missing here. It is an important point to make. Many times in a text, the most important statement in the text is the missing statement of the text. The most bold idea in a text is the idea that doesn't exist in the text. Something's missing here. What's missing here? It describes the establishment of a monarchy and the king and the obligations of the king. But then there's a missing pasuk. There's a missing verse. It's the following verse. The verse that says, "And you shall obey that king." That verse is missing. You see, according to the Torah, we're not commanded to obey the commandments of the king. And it's weird because in the book of Deuteronomy, it speaks about the prophet. And then it says, you need to obey the prophet. And it speaks about the Beit Din, the high court. And then it says, you shall obey the court. Then it speaks about the king, and then it doesn't say, you shall obey the king. The missing verse here is the most important idea here. We are not commanded to obey the king. Now it's weird, like the way Spinoza understands biblical politics, and the way many people understand politics, and the relationship between religion and politics is the following way. What's the oldest trick in the book in the relationship between religion and politics? What's the oldest trick in the book? Maybe the most important trick, not this book, but the metaphoric book. It's the following move, that you use religion in order to create stable politics. It's the following move. The king tells the people, God told me to tell you to obey me. And what's the idea here? It's turning religious piety into political obedience. So when people obey the king and their awareness, they're not obeying the king, they're obeying God that told them to obey the king. That's the oldest trick in the book. Transforming religious devotion into political obedience. That's how it works. And it was just an idea up until modernity, that the kings rule out of the consent and the grace of God or the gods. When you obey the king, you're obeying the God or the gods that appoint the king. That's the move. But that's not the move in the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy, God doesn't tell the people to obey the king. What's happening here is actually the other way around. We're not commanded to obey the king. The king is commanded to obey God. The book of Deuteronomy is not describing the king that is in control, but the king that is controlled by what? By the book, by the way, the same book that controls all of us. It's the same book. So by reversing the power, by not commanding us to obey him, but by commanding him to obey the same book that we obey, by reversing the power, this is the most important political revolution in the book of Deuteronomy. So here's a question after we read all these verses. This is what it does. Treats the king like a brother, clobbers the myth that he's the founder, limits his power, takes religious power away from him, doesn't command us to obey him. What's left from his power? Not much. And that diet to political power, he's left with not much power. And after all that, this is the final verse of these verses, of the whole political move of the book of Deuteronomy. Lema'an, all these commandments, Lema'an, Ya'arich yamim al mamlachto, so for many days and years, for a long time, he'll stay in power. Hu vanav bekerav Yisrael, him and his entire dynasty. Okay? If he obeys all these restrictions, he'll stay in power. Which means, if he won't obey these restrictions, he'll lose his power. So let's put it together. What guarantees that the king will stay in power? That he'll give up his power. This is the paradox of power, the paradox of political power in the heart of the book of Deuteronomy. You stay powerful only if you give up your power. And if you can't give up your power, if you're obsessed with control, if you're not going to give up your power, guess what? You're going to lose your power. There is an interesting tale invented or created by Rabbi Nachman Mibreslev in the 18th century. Rabbi Nachman Mibreslev has this in a story called, in a story of Maaseh B'Sheva Butlers, a story, a tale about seven butlers. There's a story inside a story there about a king that decides to do a great party. A great party because he's going to let his son inherit the kingdom while the king is still alive. There's a big party, and you could say this is a party where the king is celebrating giving away his power to his son. It's a celebration of a person that's letting go, a person that's giving away his power. And during that party, Rabbi Nachman describes, the astrologists and people that see the future come to the father, come to the king that's not the king anymore, and they say to him, we have bad news for you. It turns out your son is going to ruin the business and lose the empire and destroy the kingdom. He's going to lose his power, lose everything you've built. And they look at the king's reaction, and he's smiling and he's happy. And they ask him, didn't you hear what we just said? Why are you happy? He said, I'm happy. Why are you happy? He said, because if my son will lose the kingdom, and he'll still be happy after that, I'm happy. I'm happy because I'm a father, and my son's happy, so I'm happy. But if my son is not happy, if he's sad and upset when he loses the kingdom, so I'm happy he lost the kingdom. The paradox of power, the Rabbi Nachman noticed it, articulated it, and the paradox of power of the book of Deuteronomy is that power, the people that deserve power are the people who do not emotionally need power. And the paradox of power in the book of Deuteronomy is if you're willing to give up power, you'll stay in power, but if you can't give up power, you'll lose your power. This, I think, is a very deep idea politically and psychologically. People that are obsessed with control have a tendency to lose control. People that are not obsessed with control have a tendency to stay cool and stay in control. I think this is true about modern political history. When political leaders have what it takes not to be obsessed with controlling everything, they have more control over the process. But when you're obsessed with control, you lose control. And this takes me back to the entire move of the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy establishes a king that has limited power, a monarchy that has restrictions, a king that you don't glorify. And by doing that, it's a political revolution. And let me just set the stage for our next lecture. Where does the Bible take place? It takes place between Egypt and Mesopotamia. It takes place in between the two kingdoms that glorify kings. The two kingdoms where the monarchies have absolute power. And in between those two kingdoms, it founds a theological political system which is a radical antithesis to both systems. a king that's not glorified, monarchy that doesn't have absolute power but limited power. And this has, I think, everything to do with the theological revolution of the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy presents a political revolution and a theological revolution. The theological revolution we established last lecture, the political revolution this lecture. Next lecture, we'll try to start tying everything together. Thank you very much. In the desert, they receive the theory, the vision that they need to implement and turn into a reality when they enter the Promised Land, when they enter Eretz Canaan, when they enter Eretz Yisrael, that they deliver.